The show is live and local. It's your local performance connection. And on the show today, later on, I'll be talking with one of the conductors of the University of Illinois Symphony Orchestra, which will give its second concert of the season on Friday evening at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. Also talking with the soloist on that concert, who is a tubist named Colby Fahrenbacher. We'll be hearing an example of the piece he's playing and also hear a bit of some of the other music. That's coming up later, but first I'll be talking with storyteller, author, and folk musician Dan Ketting, who is giving a program called Tales from Darkest Night on Friday and Saturday in downtown Champaign at the Indigo Gallery. We'll hear some sample tales coming up this half hour on Live and Local. The Danse Macabre of Camille Saint-Saëns in a performance by the Minnesota Orchestra conducted by AGOA. Here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. Good afternoon, I'm Kevin Kelly. Thanks for joining me this morning. Our show today will begin with a conversation with a storyteller, Dan Ketting, who is getting the Halloween season kicked off this weekend. On Friday and Saturday night in downtown Champaign, he'll be at the Indigo Gallery starting at 7:30 each evening until about 9:30 and telling a lot of stories, including some of Edgar Allan Poe and even singing a bit as well, and we'll hear samples of both. Dan, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Kevin.
I should turn your microphone on probably, and then you can, there you go.
Okay. Nice to be here.
Yeah, well, so you're starting, I was going to say you're starting Halloween early, except that I know I got my first invitation to a Halloween party a few days ago, and my neighbor's got all of her Halloween decorations up and out, and if Christmas can start at the end of Halloween, why can't Halloween start in the beginning of October?
Well, that's true. I was at a festival in eastern Tennessee earlier in September. And it's called Haunting in the Hills. And we did a big ghost story concert. We had about 3,000 people there in the evening for ghost stories. So it's starting early and earlier. But really, when it comes down to it, people like to be scared, you know.
Speak for yourself.
Yeah. I mean, it's like people like to laugh. They like to cry. They like to get a little shiver down their spine, I think. And so ghost stories are pretty much a year-round event for storytellers.
Well, I was actually going to ask that if in many storytelling concerts, you inevitably include a ghost story.
Oh, usually, because people expect that. They really do expect it from storytellers. And it's part and parcel of the whole genre. It's that when people think of storytelling, they think first of children, which is kind of strange, but they do. And then second, it's ghost stories. And I think that historically, storytelling was more for adults historically than it was for children. The storytelling phenomena for children is more recent, more of a late 18th, early 20th, all the way through the 20th century phenomena. The Grimm's brothers didn't write their first volume for children. It was written for adults and for scholars. And the second volume, they brought it down a few tones, got rid of some of the more horrific stories to make it more acceptable for children. But the first volume was for scholars and for adults.
For scholars, because they were for collectors, essentially?
They collected these stories, and they were trying to have a Germanic folklore tradition. Well, Germany at that point was kind of, they were bringing separate states together, you know, Bavaria and Saxony, all these different Germanic states to make a German state. And it was a time of the Napoleonic era. So they were trying to have this nationalistic thing. Here are German stories. And so that's what it was all about. So for scholars, it was, here's our literature. Here's our folk literature.
I know I had heard that the original Grimm's Brothers tales were not exactly the little fairy tales or nursery rhymes that you might expect. And so I bought I don't know if it's the complete Grimm's, I can't remember, but it may be years and years ago. And I was pretty surprised reading them. They make some for some wonderful, as you say, adult entertainment.
And they have a book that came out a few years ago called Grimm's Grimmest. And those are the original ones, and which are very hard to find. And, oh, they're really, they're something else.
Can you think of any, I'm sure you can, particularly glaring examples of some where today we think of them as very sweet and innocent, but a Grimm's original might have been
really
not so.
Well, when you take a look at things like Cinderella, for example. We've fancified Cinderella, so it's just this, oh, wonderful little girl traipsing around, you know. And at the end, she forgives her sisters. That's the Disney version, which if you go to schools, that's the one kids know. But in the original...
Which is what you should do.
Right. But they were also trying to say, there's a penalty if you hurt someone. And so the penalty in Cinderella was that the first sister has her toes cut off so that the shoe will fit on her foot, and the second sister has her heel cut off by their own mother to see if that'll make the shoe fit. And then when they go to the mother is hanged outside the door to the house as a warning, and then the sisters, when they come to the wedding to try and manipulate their way into Cinderella's household, a raven perches on each of their heads and pecks out their eyes. So they're blind and they're crippled, and the mother's dead. So very different from the version now.
That sounds like a version that... Oh, of course, now that I'm saying this, I'm forgetting the name of the director who often has worked with Johnny Depp.
I know who you mean. Yes, of course.
Edward Scissorhands, that guy. Nightmare on Christmas or something like
right.
that. Tim Burton.
Tim Burton, right.
Tim Burton, yeah. That would be his rendition.
That's right, it would be.
His cinematic rendition of Cinderella. Yeah, and that's by no means the worst.
Oh, no. Sometimes you'll see that they stuff the offender into a barrel and roll him down a hill. Well, originally the barrel was filled either with spikes and glass, or it was filled with poisonous snakes and then rolled down the hill. Well, they kind of got rid of the snakes and the glass and the spikes and just rolled him down the hill like that was going to hurt anybody. But things change. They changed it quite a bit.
When were the Grimm's brothers around?
They were in the early 1800s, around the time of the Napoleonic era.
So this was definitely post-medieval torture.
Oh, yes, yes. And there was a time period when a lot of stories were moralistic stories to try and scare kids into being good. Just horrible things.
So these things would have been read, that version would have been read to kids or told to kids?
A later version with a little less violence would have been read for children. But then probably about 35, 45 years later, storytelling books, story books started coming out, and those were graphically violent on what would happen to children if they were bad. You know, they would be cut up with scissors and they'd be horrible things. But that was all these very prudish, moralistic people who are trying to get kids to be good through the fear factor. And obviously didn't work.
So I know you're going to be doing some of Edgar Allan Poe's stories at your concerts this weekend. Where does Poe fit into this? Who did he write his stories for?
Oh, he wrote for adults. He wrote totally for adults. And I think that Poe is a fascinating American author and also a great influence on other authors. And when you start looking at the people, Lovecraft and Conan Doyle, Jules Verne, Faulkner, Bradbury, they all cite him as one of their influences. And he was a real giant among writers. And he was also a critic. And that's how he made most of his money while he was alive, as being a journalistic critic. But he was a really wonderful, wonderful author. And he was the person who probably wrote the first detective novel, modern detective novel.
Which was? Was it Murder in the Rue Morgue?
Yes, yeah. Murder in the Rue Morgue. And he introduced his character. And to this day, the awards given by the mystery, the best mystery book and the best mystery short story are called the Edgar Awards.
For Edgar Allan.
For Edgar Allan Poe.
Hmm. And he was a Baltimore guy, wasn't he?
Well, born in Boston, but Baltimore claims him as their son, yes. And he had quite a strange life. He was orphaned, and tuberculosis took many, many people in his life. It took a mother, a brother, a sister, his wife. It was he had a lot of tragedy in his life. and really couldn't settle down. He went into the army, came out as a sergeant, went to West Point. He was thrown out, you know, tried to go to college, couldn't make it. But writing was his thing. And the terrible thing for him was that his main biographer when he died was one of his most hated opponents as far as journalistic criticism. They were just, they hated each other. Rufus Wilmot Griswold, I wrote it down, and he was his first biographer and became the head of the literary estate of Poe for some strange reason, I think through the publisher. And so he had this vision of Poe as an alcoholic, as a pervert, as drug-addled. And he did have a lifelong battle with alcohol, but there's no indication that he had a lifelong battle with drugs at all. But Griswold made sure that everybody thought the worst of him. And Poe's stories didn't really help either. They're so dark, you know, that it's not like, oh, well, his stories will save the day. You know, they'll make people realize, you know we're not talking Tolkien here. You know, a lot of his stories end in complete disaster in his poetry.
Yeah, they don't sound like the product of a well-balanced person.
No, they don't. Not at all. Not at all. But, you know, I still think that he's still influential. The Baltimore football team is called the Ravens after his great poem.
Is that why? You know, I never really gave any thought to that.
And they have three Ravens that come on the field, and their names are Edgar, Allen, and Poe. That's their mascots.
You know, somebody who watches football would probably know this. But
well, I knew when I did Baltimore research about Poe. I didn't know it before then. I'm not a football fan. But there's actually a ship named after him in the U.S. Navy. So it's he's still right there as far as a literary figure. Still powerful.
We're talking with Dan Ketting here on Live and Local, a storyteller, author, a folk musician. We'll be hearing him in a little bit in both roles of storyteller and musician. And giving concerts on Friday and Saturday. Do you call them concerts?
Yeah, sure.
Folk storytelling concert. Mm-hmm. Tales from Darkest Night, Friday and Saturday at 7:30 at Indigo Gallery in downtown Champaign, and including some stories of Poe. Will you be, telling any of the really longer ones?
Yes, I'll probably do Casca Amontillado, The Raven, The Mask of Red Death. They really fit into the horror scheme really well. The Telltale Heart.
Those longer ones, do you have memorized or do you read?
No, I read them because I want to make sure that the language is perfect. I've been a fan of Poe since I was a child. When I was in grade school, I was reading Poe, and I want to make sure it's all perfect because I like the way his words flow, and I don't want to make a mistake and start ad-libbing, which I do in my stories all the time.
Yeah, well, you wouldn't want to mess with that.
No, can't mess with Poe. Because whenever you do a Poe concert, there's always one Poe expert out there who knows it word for word. And, you know, they'll come up to you afterwards and say, you made a mistake, you know.
In which case you can say, well, you give the next concert.
Yeah, right. Well, you tell the next show.
And I'll sit back here and check you. Well, give us a sample or two.
Do you want a sample of Poe?
Whatever you got.
Oh, okay.
Well, we've been talking about Poe. Sure. Yeah, we should have a sample of Poe.
I'll do one of his most famous pieces because I think it's one of the more beautiful ones. And it has that melancholy feeling. And it's probably one that everyone's heard. We probably read it when we were in high school. But it's still, I think, a beautiful, beautiful poem written for his wife, Virginia. They were married secretly when she was 13, and then a year later, when she was 14, they were married publicly. A lot of criticism goes with that. They were cousins, I think, second cousins. But again, it's the times. We can't judge people getting married that young. That wasn't that unusual back in his day. So, but I'll give you one of his. Annabel Lee. It was many and many a year ago in a kingdom by the sea that a maiden lived there whom you may know by the name of Annabel Lee. This maiden she lived with no other thought than to love and be loved by me. I was a child, and she was a child, in this kingdom by the sea, but we loved with a love that was more than love, I and my Annabel Lee, with a love that the winged seraphs of heaven coveted her and me. And this was the reason that long ago, in this kingdom by the sea, a wind blew out of a cloud, chilling my beautiful Annabel Lee. So that her high-born kinsmen came and bore her away from me to shut her up in a sepulchre in this kingdom by the sea. The angels not half so happy in heaven when envying her and me. Yes, that was the reason, as all men know, in this kingdom by the sea, that the wind came out of the cloud by night, chilling and killing my Annabel Lee. But our love, it was stronger by far than the love of those who were older than we, of many far wiser than we. And neither the angels in heaven above nor the demons down under the sea can ever dissever my soul from the soul of the beautiful Annabel Lee. For the moon never beams without bringing me dreams of the beautiful Annabel Lee, and the stars never rise, but I feel the bright eyes of the beautiful Annabel Lee. And so all the night tide I lay down by the side of my darling, my life and my bride, in the sepulchre there by the sea, in her tomb by the sounding sea. And that was Annabel Lee.
By Edgar Allan Poe.
Edgar Allan Poe.
And not exactly a horror tale, but it's got a morbid quality to
it. It has that dark quality that so much of his material does. He kind of, you know, he was one of those people that the glass was always half filled, or half empty.
Half empty.
Half empty, never half filled. But his life was like that, too. He died just 2 years after Virginia died. They found him wandering the streets of Baltimore, high fever, mumbling, crazed, not wearing his own clothes, which was odd. And he died just a few days later, probably of cholera. There was an epidemic going through Baltimore at the time, but no one's quite sure.
And he lived when?
I can tell you, actually, when he was actually born. I have it right here. I have all my Poe notes. He was born in 1809.
Earlier than I would have remembered.
And so he died before the Civil War began.
So yeah, he was not old by
any means. No, he died in 1849, I believe it was. And some of his best work, like The Raven, wasn't published till towards the end of his life, 1845.
But because it was published late or just because he wrote them late?
He wrote them late. And so, but he was an amazing character. He was very well loved in France before he was even loved here. The Raven solidified his popularity here in America. But before that, the French embraced him.
The French had a habit of embracing a lot of things that artistically it seems like that the U.S. didn't initially.
Jazz musicians went and lived in France,
yeah.
You know, back in the 30s and 40s because they couldn't make a living here, and they went to France. And I think that says something about the French openness towards the arts and says a little bit about our maybe closed-mindedness towards the arts.
Yeah, we're a little behind the times in a lot of ways as far as that goes. Well, tell us a really scary one.
Real scary one.
Yeah. I'm going to sit over here and quake.
This is a story I got from my friend Mike Rust, a wonderful English storyteller. The great thing about going to England, when I go there on tour, Mike and Amy and Taffy, all these wonderful storytellers, always have a new story that they found for me, like a gift. And it's become a tradition. And they come here, I have gifts for them, stories for them. And this was one Mike told me. And it's been in Mike's family for many, many generations. And it's updated now a little bit. A long time ago in the days of Arthur, there was a magician named Merlin. And he had three sons. And to say that the sons of Merlin were ugly would be an insult to ugly people. But a father never sees that in his sons. So Merlin chose the three most beautiful women in all of Britain. But when those three maidens saw those boys, they refused to marry them. And Merlin, in his wrath, had them taken to a cliff by the North Sea. And he brought down the magical arts that were at his fingertips. And he turned those three maidens into three standing stones to face the wind and the salt spray forever. But his magic wasn't quite right. And every year, at Midsummer's Night Eve, the three standing stones turned into three maidens, and they would walk into the tide, and for hours they would scrub and scrub and scrub and try to scrub the stone from out of their flesh. And just before dawn, they would walk back to the cliff and turn to standing stones. And it was said that if you saw them, you would die. Generations went on, and a young man came back to the village where he was born near those standing stones. His wife had died, and he had a young son, and he thought his parents could help raise him. And so they did. And one Midsummer's Night Eve evening over dinner, they were talking about the curse. And he said, "It's just a story, one of those stories that storytellers tell, and who can believe a storyteller? I'll go there and prove it tonight." But his mother begged, and his father pleaded, and finally his son, with tears in his eyes, said, "Please, Father, don't." And the father relented. But just before dawn, the young boy woke up with that feeling that we've all had of something wrong, but not able to put his finger on it. And he threw his clothes on, he went to his father's room, and the bed wasn't slept in. He ran down to the sea, and as he got there, the first rays of dawn were creeping across the water, and he looked up, and he could see the last standing stone turning into position. And it was the boy that found the father in the tide, drowned. And the people knew what had happened, but the police, they put it down as an accident. And when the little boy told his grandmother what he had seen, she sent him away from the village, away from the sea, and he lived in the middle of England, and he went to school there, and he learned there. But he never saw the sea again. And when he was an old man, he decided he wanted to live by the sea, and he found a villa in Mexico on the Pacific side. And he bought it, and he shipped his books and his furniture across. And he traveled across America by train. He came to that Mexican village, and the people said, "Oh, senor, you will love your hacienda. It's beautiful." And he walked down the road towards it, and the years seemed to lift off his shoulders. And he walked in, and there were all his things ready to be put away. And there was a beautiful garden and a hedge, and he knew behind the hedge was El Pacifico, the Pacific Ocean, and he could hear it roaring. And he walked across the garden, he pulled the hedge aside, and he looked, and there he saw three standing stones at the edge of the water. And he let go of the hedges, and he thought, a coincidence. And he went back to the house, and he started putting his books in shelves and putting his things away. But when he looked out the window again, the three standing stones were on this side of the hedge. He said, "It's not happening. It can't be happening." And so the old man, he worked all afternoon, but when he looked out again, they were very, very near the center of the yard. So he poured himself a whiskey, and he sat on the veranda, and he stared, and he fell asleep. And when he woke, the three standing stones were next to the railing. And the old man put his hands on the railing, and he bent over, and one of them touched him. And they say in Mexico, there's a hacienda. And on the veranda, there's a stone, a standing stone that bends over the railing. And every year, on Midsummer's Night Eve, it turns into an old man who goes into the water and tries to scrub the stone from out of his flesh. And the people in the village will tell you, if you see him, he will surely kill you. Story of the Standing Stones.
By Dan Kitting. Well, is that by you?
Or that,
no, you said that,
story.
That's a traditional story, yeah. that you were got from friends.
Yes.
Dan will be giving a concert of Tales from Darkest Night Friday and Saturday night at 7:30 at Indigo Gallery in downtown Champaign. And you're listening to Live and Local here on FM 90.9. While Dan is setting up his guitar for a ghostly song, I will mention that you... we do have our pledge drive coming up here on about a week or so, 14 days, 10 days. And you can help every pledge go farther when you give to the Member Match Fund in advance of that pledge drive. Your contribution now will build a challenge to urge more listeners to become supporters during the kickoff power hour, 7 to 8 a.m. October 20th. You can send your check to WILL Radio, 300 North Goodwin, Urbana, Illinois, 61801, or give online at willpledge.org. That's willpledge.org. In addition to support from our listeners, our programs are made possible by Columbia Street Roastery, offering over 30 varieties and blends of whole bean or ground coffee at 24 East Columbia in Champaign. Coffee, tea, and chai are available from their retail store, in local restaurants, and through Columbia Street Roastery's coffee service. More information is available at 352-9713. So I think we've got Dan set with the guitar. Mm-hmm. And we'll do our best with sound. We're not in our regular performance studio, so you're stuck with my sound engineering, such as it is. What have you got for us? So you'll be having your guitar and a banjo at the concerts.
I'll do a ghostly song, probably each set. Yeah. And this one is called The House Carpenter. It's better known here in the United States, sometimes called The Demon Lover. It's based on an old English-Irish traditional ballad, but it's not as well known over there. But the legend is that when you die at sea, that the demons of the sea can take over your body and walk on land as you. And that's what this is all about.
Well met, my own true love. Well met, cried he. I have returned from the deep salt sea, all for the love of thee. And I could have married the king's own daughter, she would have married me, but I've forsaken her golden crown, all for the love of thee. Well, if you could have married the king's own daughter, I'm sure that you'd both happy be. Well, I am married to a house carpenter, a fine young man is he. Well, then will you forsake your house carpenter and come along with me? I'll take you where the sea grows green, by the banks of the deep blue sea. Well, if I should forsake my house, carpenter, and come along with thee, oh, what do you have to keep me on? Keep me in fine company. Six ships all out on the sea. The seventh one brought me to this land. 110 brave sailor men, they'll be at your command. Then she picked up her own wee babe, and kisses gave him three, saying, stay right here with your house carpenter, keep him in fine company. Well, they had not been sailing about 2 weeks, I'm sure that it could not have been three, when she looked down, saw his cloven hoof, and wept most bitterly. Well, then why do you weep, my fair young maid? Do you weep for your golden store, or do you weep for your house carpenter, whom you shall see no more? Well, I do not weep for my house carpenter, nor for any golden store. Oh, but I do weep for my wee little babe, whom I shall see no more. Well, they had not been traveling about 3 weeks, I'm sure that it could not have been for. When their gallant ship struck a reef and it sank to sail the seas no more. And what hills are those, my love, that rise so fair and so high? Well, those are the hills of heaven, my love, not meant for you or I. And what hills are those, my love, that rise so dark and so low? Those are the hills of hell, my love, where you and I must go, where you and I must go.
Dan Ketting. What is it called again?
What's that?
What was it called again?
The House Carpenter.
The House Carpenter. By Dan Ketting, performed by Dan Ketting here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. Thanks very much for joining us, Dan.
Thank you, Kevin. It's been great.
Yeah, and it's I'm glad you finally brought your guitar. We've mentioned it before, and now I got a chance to hear you, and folks can hear you with guitar, with banjo, and with the solo voice in a program called Tales from Darkest Night, Friday and Saturday, starting at 7:30, running till about 9:30 at Indigo Gallery in Champaign. And although the Poe stories will be the same from night to night, the other stories will vary, and the songs will probably vary.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So you can go both nights and have your timbers shivered and not have much duplication. Thanks very much for joining us, and best of luck on the program.
Thank you so much.
It's Live and Local on FM 90.9. Stay tuned next for a conversation and some samples from the University of Illinois Symphony Orchestra concert that is on Friday night at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. That's kind of a favorite piece of mine off of that particular CD, which is called Devil's Dance, featuring violinist Gil Shaham and pianist Jonathan Feldman. And in fact, it was The Devil's Dance from the film The Witches of Eastwick, music by John Williams here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. We have support for our show from the Illinois Symphony Orchestra in Tragedy and Triumph with Awadajan Pratt in Grieg's Triumphant Piano Concerto and Berlioz's Tragic Romeo and Juliet, led by music director candidate Donato Cabrera, October 14th at Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts and October 15th at Sangamon Auditorium in Springfield. Details are at ilsymphony.org. And just by way of introduction to our next segment, Don Cabrera was actually one of Professor Don Schleicher's first students at the University of Illinois. And I know he is with assistant or associate conductor of the San Francisco Symphony right now. And one of my guests on today's program is a current student of Don Schleicher at the University of Illinois. And I think, Gene, aren't you the first person in the new doctoral conducting program?
Yes, conducting. I am, actually.
So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
So you could be destined for great things coming through Don Schleicher's program here at the U of I.
Perhaps. Time will tell, I guess.
Time will tell, and your own efforts and so on. Gene is here because he is the graduate student conductor participating in the concert, along with Professor Schleicher, in the University of Illinois Symphony Orchestra concert that will be happening on Friday night at 7:30 at the Krannert Center in Urbana. And he's brought along the soloist on that concert in a tuba concerto by a man whose first name I don't even know. I'm assuming it's a first name. Ellerby?
His first name is Martin.
Martin Ellerby. And the person just speaking, whose name I do know, and I hope I do say your last name right, Kolbe Fahrenbacher.
That's right.
Tubist, who is a graduate of the program here at the University of Illinois and up in Chicago now?
Yes.
How did you get the gig here doing the concerto with the orchestra?
Well, last year I competed in the University of Illinois concerto competition, which consisted of multiple rounds. I was fortunate enough to make it all the way to the final round, where I competed against numerous fantastic musicians from the School of Music. Was fortunate to be selected as one of three winners of the concerto competition and invited back to come back and play this concerto.
I was going to say, just because you're gone doesn't mean you can't still reap the rewards.
No, that's correct.
Is this a piece that you had known? Is this the piece you auditioned on?
No, it was not, in fact. The piece I auditioned on was the Rolf Wilhelm Concertino, which only actually has a wind ensemble accompaniment. So when I had the opportunity to play with an orchestra, I wanted to take that opportunity. Martin Ellerby's concerto is a piece I've known for years and loved dearly, and thought would be a great piece to have the opportunity to play with the orchestra.
So that is one that you had worked on before. You didn't have to learn it fresh.
I actually had not looked at it before. This is the first time past 6 months have been preparation for this, but aside from hearing it, no, I had not prepared it.
So enjoyed listening, but so did you have to learn it on your own, or are you still taking lessons so that you've had somebody to help you with it?
I think the Ellerby Concerto on its own, I've had no lessons to help me through it, but the number of years I've had here at the University of Illinois with Professor Mickey Moore have given me the little voice inside of my head to help me get through it.
I took, when I was a horn player a long time ago now, Arnold Jacobs, formerly of the Chicago Symphony, was still around, and he would work with lots of different wind players of any kind, really. And I had lessons with him, a number of lessons with him, and students inevitably would record those, so that the little voice, you could take the little voice home, really, fairly literally. Mm-hmm. Is that something that you've done with Professor Moore?
On a number of occasions I have. It's been incredibly helpful, particularly in lessons you get in the spur of the moment and don't quite remember everything that that occurred, all those groundbreaking moments. now that I'm not in school anymore, I'm doing it as much as I can to really make each lesson that I have worth as much as possible.
When you say do it as much as you can, meaning?
Every lesson, pretty much.
Bring back the little voice.
Yep.
Yeah. Martin Ellerby is... from where?
American, he's a British composer.
And other pieces that you know of his, or this is the one you know?
I believe I recently heard a piece by him that actually the University of Illinois Wind Orchestra did on their last concert. The name of it escapes me, but I know of a couple of brass band pieces that he wrote. I believe one titled Chivalry. I was recently looking through some of his discography online and came across a new composition that he's in the progress of working on for a tuba sonata.
Is he a tuba player, I wonder?
I don't believe so.
Married
sure.
to a tuba player, I wonder? He's got some affinity for tuba players. He likes tuba players. Amazing that can happen. Well, let's hear a sample of the opening of the Tuba Concerto by Martin Ellerby. Who is our performers here?
The soloist on this recording is Patrick Sheridan, and he's playing it with the New York Staff Band.
Heard here on Live and Local, and you can hear Kolbe Fahrenbacher perform the piece with the U of I Symphony, conducted by Donald Schleicher, Friday evening at the Krannert Center in Urbana. Some of the opening of the Tuba Concerto by Martin Ellerby with Patrick Sheridan as the tuba soloist. He was actually at the Krannert Center, it's been several years now, I think, doing a particularly virtuosic program. And the soloist for this piece, in this piece with the University of Illinois Symphony Orchestra. Friday night in Urbana is going to be Colby Fehrenbacher, who's with us here on Live and Local. And again, I don't know the piece. Does it get, I imagine later on it gets more lively and virtuosic and exciting and so on?
Yes, it definitely does. The piece is composed as one movement, and the beginning, the opening, the first half is very lyrical, slow, and then quickly picks up pace and becomes incredibly energetic and fun.
And difficult?
To an extent, yes.
That's partly the idea, right? To make it sound like the tuba players are working.
Yes.
And also on the concert will be music by Tchaikovsky, his Romeo and Juliet Fantasy Overture, and by Joan Tower, so another newer piece. It's called Made in America. And Don Schleicher, a professor of conducting and also the music director of the symphony, will be conducting both of those pieces. The concert will open with Rossini's William Tell Overture, which will be conducted by doctoral student Eugene Power. And Gene's with us here as well. Gene, you were in the, you had a high school band before you came into the orchestral program here?
Right. I was actually a high school band director in Wisconsin for 8 years before I came to the U of I.
And did you give up on bands, or what made you decide to come into an orchestral conducting program?
Oh, I had actually studied in my undergrad some conducting with the University of Wisconsin Eau Claire Symphony Orchestra and their conductor, who was my first mentor as a young conductor. And I became a high school band director, but I still continued to work with the Chippewa Valley Symphony as the assistant conductor. And then I became the music director of the Chippewa Valley Youth Symphony. These are both in western Wisconsin. And I was the music director there for about 4 years. And so I've been constantly involved with orchestra over the last decade, but really my day job, I guess you could say, was the band directing. And then I did all the orchestra stuff on the side, so to speak.
So now you're working towards switching that around, or maybe supplanting the one entirely.
Right. Right.
Is the idea. This, speaking of youth orchestras, the couple of times I've had a chance to conduct this piece, William Tell, we're both with youth orchestras, and the initial challenge is getting all the cellos together,
right,
particularly if they're of youth orchestra level of player.
Yeah.
Is that still a challenge with college level of player to get the parts sorted out and everybody listening and tuning and all of that stuff?
Well, I think that the William Tell is the kind of piece that is done so frequently and it's so well known that I really feel like people, I know this is no problem. And then you find out there's a lot of music, intonation and things like that are lurking under the surface. So that's a challenge for everybody, even the most seasoned doctoral cello students. But at the same time, it's more of a, for older, more mature musicians, it's more of an opportunity to create chamber music within the context of a full orchestra. So from my perspective, there's less hands-on that I have to do, and I can let them just kind of play and collaborate with them more. But with the youth orchestra, getting them together is a little bit tricky, and I definitely understand that. So this is a much, I guess, more hands-off approach that I get to take here when I'm
at the beginning of the piece. Anyway.
At the beginning of the piece, certainly. Yeah. Yeah.
And this is, of course, the not the most famous part of the piece, of the William Tell,
right,
which we're not going to bother to sample. People can imagine that in their head. But this is the part that it's like the beginning of a song where everybody knows the verse and the chorus, mm-hmm, but they don't know the opening. And
right.
So this is the opening to the William Tell Overture of Rossini.
Thank you.
wonderful solo vehicle for the principal cellist of an orchestra, that opening, deceptive opening of the William Tell Overture. Of course, that's the overture to his last opera by Gioachino Rossini, because it does, of course, take on the character that most of us know later on. And that's will be the opening piece on the University of Illinois Symphony Orchestra concert Friday night at the Kranert Center in Urbana. And Gene, why don't you just tell us just the briefest bit about Joan Tower's piece, Made in America? I don't know anything about that mm-hmm. one either.
Well, it's a more modern composition, and it's an interesting the way that she was commissioned to write it. She was a commission from 70 different orchestras around the country that all pitched in a certain amount of money to get the work as a premiere for their seasons. And so there were youth orchestras, there were professional orchestras, this big pool. And basically the idea was that it would be a work that would showcase some Americana. And so there are fragments of America the Beautiful hidden throughout the piece. But the work is very original and very interesting. It's very rhythmic and exciting and very lush and very beautiful as well. And Joan Tower is, of course, one of our most important American composers right now.
You said 70 orchestras?
Yeah, something like 70 orchestras.
She must have made some pretty good money off of this one.
Well, they didn't have to pay a full commission fee, but I'm sure she got good publicity because that many orchestras performed the work in the premiere year, and of course, she got the commission from it. So
was the U of I one of the orchestras in the commissioning pool, or we're just getting it after the piece?
We're getting it now, and Professor Schleicher mentioned that we may be the only academic institution mm-hmm. that's performed this piece in the country. Don't quote me on that, but that this has been done by professional orchestras and things like this. Is the first time that a university has done this piece.
Okay, folks, don't quote him on it, but you did hear him say it.
I did say it, yeah.
You can now look it up.
He did mention that.
So. All right. Well, then you can quote Don Schleicher on that.
Sure.
Well, we've run a little short of time for what I hope to have had a little bit, played a little bit of the Tchaikovsky Romeo and Juliet Fantasy Overture, but that's another one that is an ever-popular favorite with audiences and another reason to go here this concert Friday night at the Kranert Center. Thanks, gentlemen, very much for joining us. Colby Fehrenbacher, tuba soloist, and Gene Power, who's going to be the graduate student conductor of the Rossini on Friday's concert.
Thank you.
You're listening to 90.9 WYNL FM and HD Urbana with translators W266 AF Urbana and W293 AF Danville, NPR Classical Music, and more for Central Illinois. Support comes in part from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wines, beers, and spirits for the serious collector to the first-time buyer. More information is available at thecorkscrew.com.